Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Barbara Massey, a member of the Club Science and Technology member-led forum and your chair for today. We are also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Today, the Commonwealth Club is honored to present to you the creator of a very exciting aviation project, the Perlan Project. Einar Ennevoldsen has been an aviation pioneer for the past 60 years. He has been an Air Force pilot, a NASA test pilot, and has been a consultant to the development of many different aircraft. His testing piloting experience has been extensive and has included the notable aircraft pictured on this screen: the Blackbird, the British Lightning Interceptor, the special version of the F-111, nicknamed McNamara's Folly, the German DLR Strato 2C, a prototype propeller airplane designed to fly at altitudes of up to 80,000 feet with an actual flight altitude of 61,000, the I-36 glider for NASA's Deep Stall Glider project, and he's also proved the possibility of an engineless landing for the space shuttle when he tested NASA's X-24B, a predecessor craft to the space shuttle. He worked to make engine controls more like those of a computer by testing NASA's F-115 with modified electronic engine controls, and he's tested the skewed wing airplane. Mr. Ennevoldsen is not only a pilot, he's an engineer. Based on his understanding of the environment and physics, he's been able to project the outer limits of flight using a sailplane. He has reached the surprising conclusion that he could fly a sailplane to altitudes that have only been visited by astronauts. On August 30, 2006, after testing the aircraft and testing his different locations for catching mountain waves, Einar Ennevoldsen and Steve Fawcett were able to fly a specially designed sailplane from El Calafate, Argentina, to the record altitude of 50,671 feet. His ability to reach this altitude without an engine and using only the wind is extraordinary. However, the most exciting news is that this is only halfway to his goal. Mr. Ennevoldsen has graciously agreed to speak to us about his project. Please welcome Einar Ennevoldsen.
Thank you, Barbara, for that very nice introduction. Before I start, I want to note that I saw in the Chronicle this morning that in 1934 on this day, the longshoremen initiated a general strike. here I am teaching one of my high school buddies to fly. His name was Alan Hendrickson, and his father, Eric, was a longshoreman. Eric retired when he was 65 after 30 or 40 years of carrying stuff out of ships and onto the dock like a mule, and was able to retire and build his dream house in Lake Tahoe. And I think that's a great tribute to the achievement of the longshoreman. We'll start with some definitions. I want to some basic ideas. I want to keep everybody with me and not get off into my own talking to myself here. These are nacreous clouds, sometimes called mother of pearl clouds. They form in winter at high latitudes. They form both north and south, but in the north, there's actually people. And these have been sort of mystical objects for throughout history. They're also called polar stratospheric clouds. And between 30 and 40 years ago, when the ozone hole was first discovered and became an object of intense scientific interest, these clouds came in for the first time, became closely studied. And we'll get into that a little further. These clouds normally, you couldn't see in broad daylight. They're so tenuous. There's very few particles there, very small particles and widely spaced. But when at the Arctic Circle in winter, where it's dark on the ground and they're in bright sunlight with the grazing angle of the sun, they're brightly illuminated and they have an iridescent quality. Oops, wrong button. This is the picture that changed my life. It's another picture of a polar stratospheric cloud, and let me talk you through it a little bit here. This was taken over Mount Kebnekaise, which is at the Arctic Circle, on the border between Sweden and Norway. It's about 7,000 feet high, not very high. The thing to note is the height of this. This is a cloud, and this is a false color picture, and it's created by a laser which fires up, and it bounces off any particles that might be up there, and the reflection will have a polarization and a spectrum that you can analyze to find out what it bounced from. Sometimes you can find that out, and you can sometimes tell what the temperature is. The note is the undulating character of the layer of whatever it is, particles, that you see. It could be a meteor trail. It could be a volcanic layer from an eruption, which frequently are seen here in pictures of this kind. In this case, it happens to be a cloud, and it's a polar stratospheric cloud. And the black part down here in the middle is water ice, at a temperature of about minus 86 centigrade. And the red and the yellow part is nitric acid trihydrate at a temperature of around minus 80 to minus 83 centigrade. And at these conditions, it requires those cold conditions for both those clouds to form, for both those particles to form. And on the surface of those particles, a complex series of chemical reactions take place, which set up the stage later in the spring for ozone to be catalytically destroyed very rapidly. This picture, I saw this picture on the wall when I was working on that funny big airplane that you saw the picture of, and we were developing the specifications for that airplane with the DLR, which is a German scientific governmental organization. And at a meeting with meteorologists near Munich, I saw this picture on the wall. And I saw that and I thought, that's a wave, which we'll talk about later. That's a wave in the atmosphere. So I immediately walked into the guy's office. His name was Wolfgang Ringer, and he told me he'd been trying since 1950 to get that picture. And he finally got the technical apparatus to get that picture with this laser business. And he was first thing he did was go out and post it on the wall for all to see. So I asked him about the winds. There's wind blowing from left to right here. And I asked him how strong the wind was, and he told me. And I looked at the slope of this thing, and I thought, the wind is blowing uphill here. And if I had my glider right there, I could be surfing on that wind at 75,000 feet. That's 23 kilometers, about 75,000 feet. So at that point, I really had no choice. I had to pursue this possibility. Okay, here's another term. I use glider, the word glider, and the word sailplane. This is happens to be the sailplane we used. Steve Fawcett bought this for us. It's a German-built production. Actually, a lot of it's built in Slovenia for low labor costs. But it's made out of carbon fiber. It's extremely strong. It's built to fly in the strongest turbulence you can find on Earth. It's superbly and precisely controllable. It weighs about 1,800 pounds fully loaded. It had a retractable engine that fit back here. We took out the engine because we needed the space and the weight to put in our high altitude liquid oxygen and batteries. And we have an emergency parachute on the back to straighten the airplane up and bring it down quickly from high altitude if it's required. And the airplane is very efficient. If we were from a mile high, you can glide 50 miles in this glider. It's not the most efficient glider, but it's a good, solid, production, proficient, efficient glider. I'll talk about the polar vortex. At the winter end of the Earth, when the atmosphere goes into the shadow of the Earth, it doesn't get any heat, and it radiates its energy into space, and it cools a lot, and it descends. And it, as it descends, it goes into a clockwise swirl, and it swirls quite rapidly around the pole. And this gets quite pronounced and strong starting at the beginning of winter, and then it abruptly ceases at the end of winter. Within a week at the most, sometimes within a day, it'll just be whirling around there, and it'll stop. That's as the as the sun starts shining and the air stops cooling and it stops descending, this vortex quits. As soon as I realized the nature of this cloud and this wave at this high altitude, I started a worldwide search for more information and for sponsors, and it went a lot of different places. I went to the Norwegian Arctic Exploration Society, and they told me, we think it's a good idea. We'd like to be sure that it's a good idea. So I was going to launch some balloons in Norway and watch the balloons fly through the wave. Great. Wonderful. Thank you. And they sent me to Texas, and Texas sent me to a professor, Jim Rosen, at the University of Wyoming. And he sent me and said we should go to New Zealand. And so I put together the whole story and gathered quite a bit of data that shows that this actually exists, and I went looking for sponsors. One of the first places I looked was Baron Hilton, who is Paris's granddaddy, and he's a great aviation enthusiast and a benefactor, and he had just gotten swindled by another aviation project, and he was a little gun-shy. And he said, gee, that's an interesting project, but I don't want to put any money in it. But he told Steve Fawcett about it, and who was a friend. And Steve called me up and said, I hear you have this interesting possibility. So we argued and negotiated extensively for about 7 seconds and agreed to pursue this project. And the whole collaboration really couldn't have worked better. He put up the money and didn't complain about it, and was very talented and easy to work with, and we went on from there. Does that help? Get my paraphernalia together here. So where we left off was the swirl. And the swirl has the effect of isolating the interior of the vortex from the outside of the vortex, because any air that starts from the inside and starts to go outside gets swept up in this swirl, and it just goes around the circle, and it never gets outside. And similarly, any air that starts toward the vortex gets into the swirl, and it never gets inside. So that keeps, for instance, the ozone hole, or the chemical precursor to the ozone hole, isolated and concentrated in the middle of the vortex. The periphery of the vortex is where the highest speed wind is, and it tends to form a kind of a rope of high-speed wind going around the outside, and it's known as the stratospheric polar night jet, or the night jet. And that's an object of fairly recent study, and you know, you don't hear about it on Channel 7, and it has very little impact, as far as no direct impact on next week's weather. It has a profound impact on next year's weather, but it's still a subject of great interest. This is an animation that was produced, I believe, by NASA. And let me show where we are here. Here's Greenland. We're looking. This is an animation. It'll be an animation of the polar vortex and the night jet and the northern hemisphere. And here's Greenland. Here's Iceland. You can make out Scandinavia here, Spitsbergen or Svalbard and Canada. North Pole's about here. Let's see if this will run. Can't make the thing. There we are. Okay. Well, that'd be nice. There we go. And there it is. And you can see that it wobbles around, and it's about to see what size it is. And this periphery is the night jet. And this starts about, end of December and ends about the end of March. And it just stops abruptly when the end of the Earth comes back into the sun, starts coming back into the sun. I'll run it one more time here. Maybe we can see the whole thing. And that's primarily happening at an altitude of around 100,000 feet. Okay, come on. There we go. Okay, now I'm going to talk about a mountain wave. And I want to try to explain as much as I can here on this this picture that I took off the web. The black stuff here, that's the Earth. And for a mountain wave to occur, you need some lumps, like mountains. They don't have to be real big, 2,000 feet, 3,000 feet, 10,000 feet. You need some bumps. You don't. You need at least one bump. You may or may not have bumps downstream. It could be flat. It could be some more bumps. Here's a cloud over the mountains. It might be there. It might not be there. This might be, say, the Sierras, and this might be just San Joaquin Valley and a bunch of winter clouds there, and it's dropping down the backside. Here's some wind, and I'll get to it later, but we have a condition where the wind must increase as the altitude increases. We don't want any of these arrows to be short. We don't want some altitude band to have reduced winds. Introduce the word troposphere, and that's the lower part of the atmosphere where we live. Here, troposphere goes up about 35,000 feet, but it's quite variable, both in location, where on the Earth that you are, and season, and whatever the day is. Tropopause is the boundary between the troposphere and the stratosphere, and the stratosphere is up here. In the troposphere, in general, the air tends to get colder as you go higher. Then in the stratosphere, it does not get colder anymore. It may get a little warmer. It may stay about the same, but that's the definition of these terms that I'll use. So here, this gray stuff, here's more clouds, and this is sometimes called a rotor cloud or Lee rotors. And there may be one of them, there may be none of them, there may be two of them, maybe a whole sequence of them. And these little things are lenticular clouds, and they're drawn kind of lumpy, but in reality, as you'll see in some pictures, lenticular clouds are almost always very smooth, feather-like, or like a dish of china. And what the air is doing, it comes here, it'll plunge down the side of the mountain, and then it'll bounce. And it may bounce whether or not there's another mountain down here. It'll go into a bounce, and it may bounce more than once, or it may just bounce once and then straighten out. And it may continue on up to high altitude, and it may just go up to a certain altitude and flatten out. So there's an endless variety of configurations it may have. Now, to soar in the wave, what we do is we position the glider in this upward, where the wind has an upward component. And say the glider is coming down, say, at 5 miles an hour through the air, and the upward component of the air is at 10 miles an hour, the net result is that the glider is going up 5 miles an hour. So basically, you're just like I think I ran out of batteries. Boy, one catastrophe after another. So as long as this wave is here, and if you're in the right place, the glider will go up, just like a surfer at Mavericks. He can go up and down the face of the wave. This is an example of a wave, once again, in northern Scandinavia. And I knew I should have brought a battery. Let me take this other mic. So here we are back here over Finland and going west to Norway. And the wind is coming the other way. It's coming from Norway over to Finland. And it bounces over the high mountains at the ridge of between Norway and Sweden, and it sets up a train of waves. And the train goes quite a long distance at low altitude. Here we have 12 kilometers, or about 40,000 feet. And NASA has a magic instrument. They flew this in a NASA Research DC-8. And it looks above and below the airplane, and it can show the trajectory of the wind field. And you can see these are quite high amplitude. These are 1 kilometer each, so this is about a 3 kilometer double amplitude. And then near the tropopause at 40,000 feet, the amplitude shrinks quite a bit, and then it starts to increase again. And here we only have a couple of major waves. But the significant and the interesting thing is that these waves do and must increase in amplitude as the altitude increases. You've proved that with a kind of a conservation of energy argument. It's called the Palm-Eliasson theorem. But what eventually happens is, as you can see, it gets steeper and steeper, and at some altitude, it's going to become unstable and crash, like a kind of analogous to on the beach, and they call it a breaking wave. And the breaking wave is of considerable current interest because it creates a big turbulence field downwind of the breaking wave, and in that turbulence field, there's a great deal of transfer of momentum, energy, and particulate matter in the atmosphere, which otherwise would not occur. The air is very slippery, and these bands of air will slide across each other, and they don't really have much interaction, except where there's turbulence. And the breaking waves provide the turbulence, and how and when and where waves are likely to break is it's not forecastable at the moment. So this, too, is a subject of current scientific interest. This is just a kind of a neat picture. This was taken about 1950 or 51, and we're right over the town of Bishop, and we're looking south toward Mount Whitney and the Owens Lake and points south, and over here where the dust starts up is Highway 395. And this was a famous called a downslope windstorm and it blew over buses and blew down power lines and generally raised a lot of cane. It's, you know, just as severe as it looks. There was a very adventurous pilot who had a contract with PG&E to seed clouds over the Sierras, and he had a P-38 that PG&E bought after the war, and they put a grinder in there, and they ground up dry ice particles, and he flew over the clouds and tried to increase the snowpack where the PG&E owned the water rights. So once again, here's one of those cases where if you were flying along and saw this, you'd be well advised to go the other direction. About a year after this picture was taken, there was a famous project called the Sierra Wave Project, and it was funded by the U.S. Air Force. And they had some iron men and wooden ships, some wooden and canvas gliders, that flew up 44,000 feet high in 1952, which was higher than anything except experimental rocket planes practically at that time. And they learned a lot about mountain waves, about rotors. They wrote operating manuals for United Airlines that flew over the western United States. It was a marvelous project. And I had the pleasure of being a junior mechanic working on the airplane, I think, in 1952, just for a couple of weeks during one of my school vacations. But there's a current project going on right at the same time in this same area called T-REX, just their acronym. But it's to study wind patterns of this kind and try to improve the forecastability and determine the limits of how turbulent it could get. A lot of it's funded by Airbus, and it's, there's 30 or 40 different nations that contribute to this thing. There's a lot of sensors on the ground, a lot of lasers shooting up into the air, and some brave airplanes that sort of look around the corners of this thing with trying not to get in the worst of it. And they're trying to find out how bad turbulence could get, but nobody really knows. Just show you a few pictures of lenticular clouds. You can see they're generally pretty smooth. There's a few little wispy things underneath, and those are different. It's a different type of rotor cloud, but it's the same thing as the cloud you saw in the diagram, and it indicates a lot of turbulence, whereas the lenticular clouds above are extremely smooth. And there's another one in New Zealand. There's another one in the Mojave Desert, slightly different configuration of the rotor clouds. The interesting thing about the lenticular clouds is that the wind is blowing maybe 100 miles an hour, but the cloud is stationary. You know, how does it do that? Air is going up on this side. The wind is coming from here, right or left or whatever that is. And the air is going up, and as it goes up, it cools adiabatically until it reaches condensation temperature. The cloud forms. Then it goes over and it arcs back down, and it warms again adiabatically. The cloud dissipates. So the cloud is constantly forming at the front, disappearing at the back, and the cloud actually stays stationary. And if you're up at skiing and you look out at night and you look up and you see a beautiful cloud up there in the moonlight, and you can see the wind is just tearing through it, and then you look for a few more seconds and you realize the cloud isn't moving, even though you can see the wind tearing through it, and that's what's happening there. Another pretty bunch of clouds. There's some over Mount Rainier, just a big stack of saucers. So, Steve Fawcett bought the glider, and we started the Pearland project. And that's my friend Ken Briglib. It was about a year's work modifying the glider, putting in all the equipment we needed. And that just illustrates that it seems like anything you do on an airplane is very inconvenient. There's the liquid oxygen. We put in two 10-liter liquid oxygen dewars and heat exchangers to make sure the oxygen was gaseous when we breathed it. And then there's some big battery compartments back here. And there were numerous other modifications. NASA was incredibly supportive. NASA, primarily we needed them for the pressure suits. So NASA originally gave us two pressure suits, but after the first year, the pressure suits' life expired. So they asked the Air Force to provide pressure suits to us, which the Air Force did from Beale Air Force Base. Those are U-2 suits or SR-71 suits, either one. And then NASA also provided an instrumentation engineer who built up a pack of sensors and recorders that recorded data that NASA thought was important, and we always flew with that. And then they provided a meteorologist to follow along with what we were doing. And then we have to have an extremely well-qualified pressure suit technician. Whenever you take a pressure suit, particularly out of the country, it's always got to be in the custody of some authorized person, and then you can't just take a pressure suit and use it. You got to have somebody there that tests it every day, pre-flights it, puts you in it, takes you out of it, dries it out, and makes sure everything is working right. And here he's putting Steve into the suit, and Steve adapted very well to the suit. The suit certainly is capable of producing claustrophobia in people. When you're inside, you're a lot further away than it looks like when you're on the outside looking in. Steve had to hire the pressure suit technician. That's Corky Cortez, his day job is a pressure suit technician at NASA Houston. The suit is basically a rubber bag that's encased in a very strong fabric overgarment, and one of the problems is that it'd be very easy to get sweaty in the thing, and if you're sweaty and you go up where it's really cold, well, that's a big problem. So the trick is to do as little as possible and just sort of become a limp noodle, and you just lie down in the airplane, and other people do everything for you before you fly. They strap you in and they arrange your checklists and they close the canopy, and they pull you out, and they hook you up, and they point you, and they say, go. And then you do your best to stay cool, and it actually worked pretty well. Now, in the U-2, in those airplanes, they've got a big engine that provides a huge amount of cooling air and blows through the suit all the time, so it's not a problem. But we don't have that, so we had to just stay cool. So here we are, ready to fly. There's Steve in the back, me in the front. And we're ready to take off. We leave these little fresh air vents wide open until we get to about 25,000 feet and to get as cold as possible. And then at 25,000 feet, we close them and hope we don't get any colder, although that actually doesn't happen. Now, actually, because of the bends, caissons disease, I think we're not really ready to fly because you have to have the faceplate down and breathe pure oxygen for at least an hour before you get above 16,000 feet. And then the suit maintains your body at about 35,000 feet once you go above that. And you'd be susceptible to getting the bends at 35,000 feet if you didn't try to wash out as much of the nitrogen or some of the nitrogen. We never had trouble with the bends. We flew in California, we flew in New Zealand, we flew in Patagonia, and everywhere we fly, it's in the winter in a desert, which is frequently disagreeable conditions on the ground. Okay, here's what we're looking at here. We're looking straight down to the South Pole. This is Antarctica. Here's South America. Here's New Zealand and Australia. In Africa, and we're looking at the winds at 100,000 feet, and the color depicts the winds. So this circular structure is the night jet, the polar night jet. This is not a particularly strong one. Its maximum winds about 220 knots at 100,000 feet. It's kind of an irregular shape. The shape over a period of days it'll flatten and become circular. It'll clock around the Earth typically in a clockwise direction, takes about a week. So just looking at this, we'd guess that that this high winds would be over the tip of South America in a day or two. But that happens to be at the time we flew our highest flight, 51,500 feet. And this explains why we went where we went. We need to be at around 50 degrees, between 50 and 55 degrees south latitude. And it's the only place on Earth that where you have land at that latitude. And fortunately, we have a nice mountain range right there. We flew for three seasons in New Zealand, which is a little too far north, and it's cocked off a little at an angle. It's not straight against the wind typically blows west to east, and so it's hitting the mountains at an angle, and it doesn't make quite as dependable a waves. Now, we chose the southern hemisphere because the polar vortex and the night jet comes up to 50 degrees pretty commonly. At the northern hemisphere, it seldom comes below, say, 65 degrees. And that means that since you have to do it in the winter, it's going to be dark most of the time in the northern hemisphere. So it seems a lot nicer to do it in the daylight, and it's warmer at the slightly more equatorial latitudes. So that's why we went to the southern hemisphere. And that's where we went, El Calafate, in Patagonia, where the wind always blows, renowned winds. The poor Guanaco's got all his hair blowing the wrong way here. And here's a Google Earth depiction of the location. Here's El Calafate. Here's the Andes. We go off down toward Tierra del Fuego and Antarctica, and up here we head toward north of Argentina and Bolivia. Over here is the Pacific Ocean and Chile. Come to the Andes, and then off over here to the Atlantic. And we have these large glacial lakes. Have some big, several big glaciers here. Large glacier. This is Lago Argentino. We flew primarily over the high ground, a place called Torres del Paine, and around Cerro Fitzroy. And if any of you are trekkers, you'd know those places. They're absolutely the world's finest trekking and some of the most beautiful lands in the world. And amazingly enough, at this little town of El Calafate at the tip of South America is a very nice international airport. And they get about two MD-80 flights a day in the winter, so they're happy to have something to do, and they made us extremely welcome. They cleared out their own office space to make a place for our pressure suit operation. They let us tie the airplane down. They gave us, certainly let us free roam the airplane, the whole airport freely, which I'm sure would be difficult to achieve in the United States. We shipped everything. Here's a container, 40-foot container. We shipped everything to Buenos Aires in a ship, and then put it on a flatbed truck, and 96 hours later, you're in El Calafate. And we have to ship our liquid oxygen. It's a big logistical thing. It tends to boil off in a couple of weeks, so you have to keep getting new liquid oxygen shipped 96 hours also from Buenos Aires. There's our tow plane. It's an Argentine-built semi-cub-type airplane. It has about 200 horsepower. And there we are getting ready to take off. You can see we're pointed toward the Andes. And I don't know if you can, probably can't see it, but here we are. Here's the tow plane, and here's us. We got about a 200-foot rope there he pulls us up with. He flies at about 70 miles an hour, and it takes about an hour to reach the Andes. Our ground crew took this picture. The tower people, the air traffic people and the tower people, would welcome our ground crew to come up in the tower during the flights. And Susana, my wife, was the translator because neither Steve nor I spoke Spanish, and some tower operators spoke pretty good English, and some just knew the standard phraseology, you know, like hold northeast at the NDB, 2 minute turns, and just the things they had to tell you. But if it was anything non-standard, which everything we said was non-standard, well, it took some translation. One time they told us to hold out there at 21 miles at a 310 degree radial and not go below 17,000, and it turned out there's a big downdraft there. So trying to get this idea across to the tower just wasn't going to work. We had to go someplace else where we could hold altitude. There's our handsome gaucho Argentine tow pilot, Agustin. And he was kind enough to take some pictures from the tow plane on the way up there. You can see the glaciers coming down out of the Andes. You can see icebergs floating down the lake. So we'd finally tow out. We'd get past these clouds and tow out into a clear area. By the time we get to the Andes, we'd be about 12,000 feet where we'd cast off. Tow plane would go home and we'd be on our own. And there we are climbing up in front of some of those beautiful lenticular clouds. The climb rate could be very strong. We climbed almost 2,000 feet a minute to 35,000 feet, just zoomed up there. Then at 35,000, the structure, the wave structure became complex, and we couldn't get any higher at that point, and we had to hunt around a bit and drop back to a second wave, which carried us higher. Yeah, I've got another picture here. The same kind of thing. We eventually went completely above all the clouds. The highest cloud is about 35,000. And then the pressure suit starts to inflate, and it really wasn't practical in the suit to take pictures. I didn't have a special camera, which was a big piece of bad planning, because the little camera and the big inflated pressure suit gloves, you couldn't work those little tiny buttons. And so I just... And there, you couldn't get the camera stowed away because the cockpit was really not really well suited to the inflated pressure suit, which was not a surprise to us. We knew that before we started. The surprise was that it was not as easy to climb as we thought. We thought it would be strong lift all the way up, and in fact, it was quite weak lift for a couple of hours. So it took a lot of wrestling around with the inflated suits, and where we thought we might be 20 or 30 minutes of just kind of pointing into wind and going up. So that part of our plan was not quite as we had hoped it would be. Okay, I guess I jumped ahead there with the picture, but on the way up, eventually we got up. The suits maintain a constant internal altitude, and as the air pressure decreases, the suits get stiffer, and they get up to about 2 psi at 50,000 feet, which is fairly stiff and causes a number of practical difficulties, like they actually push the sides of the glider out about an inch due to the inflation, which in the process traps your arms, so you can't reach anything except the control stick. And then the legs inflate. They're big tubes. They go right past the control stick, so the legs inflate. So you can't move the stick sideways very well. It takes quite a lot of effort to push against the legs. And then the belly of Steve's suit inflates and pushes the stick forward. So I have to hold it back with both hands while steering. And this gradually gets to be tiring, and then it does tend to get cold. It was minus 65 at 35,000 and minus 59 at 50,000. And interestingly, it was sensibly, you could tell that it was warmer at or it was less cold at 50,000. Partly the temperature was higher, but also the air is about essentially half the density that it is at 35, so the heat transfer rate is not nearly as high. And so you don't chill as fast because of the thin air. But it was still cold. So we thought about it for a while, and we could see, this isn't the case, but it's similar. We see a big cloud up, we were down over Torres del Paine, and we could see up at Cerro Fitzroy, then a big stack of those beautiful lenticulars, and thought about going up there, and then we thought, well, I think we've actually proved what we wanted to prove, and it's getting cold, so let's go home. So we use these panels here, these big air brakes on top of the wing. Without those, it would take us two or three hours to get down. But with those, we just come right down very nicely in about a half hour. Interestingly, I'll jump ahead a little bit, but if we'd gone a couple thousand feet higher, the model prediction showed an area of substantial turbulence right where we flew, but a little bit above us. And when we were flying, it was completely smooth. But we were prepared for a lot of turbulence, but never actually encountered any. And there we are, we're back at El Calafate. And as I say, it's a beautifully controllable airplane. And you just land and you just roll right up and put your wingtip in your ground crew's hand as you stop. And so we were pleased at that. These are some of the people that it takes to do the job. You have the airport manager, then the Argentine Air Force airport commander. There's NASA instrumentation engineer. This is an Argentine general factotum. This is a wife translator. That's me. That's Steve. There's our handsome tow pilot. There's Corky, the pressure suit guy. Here's an ace mechanic and a very skilled glider pilot, too. And Steve's pilot for his personal jet. His co-pilot for his personal jet, and he also a big help pushing the glider around and doing things like that. Okay, here's I want to talk you through this. This shows what the wind conditions were at the time and place we were flying. Here's the equator. Here's the South Pole. Here's the ground, and here's 100,000 feet, and we're looking at a plane that goes from the equator to the South Pole at the longitude where we flew. So we were at our highest altitude. We were right here, and the colors depict the strength of the wind. So you're just looking up, and this is just a picture of how strong the wind was where and when we flew. Some of the features here. Here's the subtropical jet stream. When you're going to Miami and we're coming back and he says we're going to be late because we got the jet right on the nose, he's probably talking about the subtropical jet stream. There's usually a couple of jet streams. There's often the polar jet at a slightly higher latitude. And here's the polar jet. It's pretty weak. And here's the night jet, just as advertised, not terribly strong, over us, it's about 140, 150 knots at 100,000 feet. And here's us at 51,000 feet at 50 degrees south, 72 degrees west latitude, 72 and a half. Remember I said the condition for the wave to propagate vertically is that the wind does not want to get weaker as you go higher. And we didn't quite make that. Because of this polar jet, we got a little bit more wind here. As we went higher, the wind dropped off just a wee bit, not a lot. It was enough to make the wave weak, but not enough to kill it. And then as we'd gone higher, we were getting into a more favorable situation. And if this whole pattern should move north another 5 degrees, then we'd be in a perfect situation where, as we went up, we'd go into continuously increasing winds, and the wave would have a better configuration, easier to fly. And I'm sure that happens frequently. It just didn't happen the time we were there. Let me go back to that other one a minute. You should be asking, how do you know all this? How do you know what the wind is like that? Because below about 45 degrees south latitude, there's, I think, five or six weather stations in the world that actually send up balloons and actually give you any data. So how do you know all this stuff? Well, it comes out of the global model, same place that Channel 4 weather comes out of, but it goes over the whole world, and it's updated every 6 hours, and we found it to be surprisingly accurate. This is another model. One of our collaborators was Dr. Jim Doyle down at the Naval Research Lab at Monterey, and his day job is to study mountain waves. And now let me explain this one. Okay, it's just like that other picture, except it's a very fine scale. It's not to the equator, and it's rotated 90 degrees. Here we have the Pacific. Yeah, here we have the Pacific. Here we come, this little bumps are the islands, and then Chile, and then we come to the Andes, and then here's Argentina, and it goes off over to the Atlantic. And here is, these are meters in this case, and here are 0 to 20,000 meters, or about 66,000 feet. And the colors depict the updraft, downdraft strength. And so the dark red is strong updraft, and the blue and green is downdraft. And so this shows how this was predicted 36 hours before we flew, and the boundary condition was taken from the global model. They input this to a fine grid, a very fine scale grid, the boundary condition from the global model, and then they run this model at higher resolution. And this happens to be a highly simplified, they call it a linear model, and it computationally doesn't take a lot of computer time. And it shows that a big wave goes up here to 12,000 meters, well, maybe 11,000 meters, and it starts to get weaker. And then another wave behind it starts about 9 nautical miles back. Another wave starts, and it goes up, and then 9 miles further back, another wave goes up. So that's a fairly typical. You can look at these things. He cranks them out all the time, and they get infinite number of configurations, but they all look something like that. So, okay, I'll get finished here. Here's where we actually flew, this wiggly green line. I hope you can see this wiggly green line. That's our GPS track. That's where we actually were. So that's how good his prediction was. We flew right in his predicted lift pattern. And it's, I thought, quite amazing. That's a high-resolution model. It contains all the atmospheric physics. And it basically says pretty much the same thing the other one does, but this one takes lots of computer time on a big, fast computer. There's also a lot of interest. There's another scientist at Jet Propulsion Lab at Pasadena, and he looks for mountain waves in satellite data. This is the AIR satellite, and I'll just say that the colors in there depict temperature anomalies due to the air moving up and down in mountain waves, and it shows that all the activity. The strongest activity is right where we were flying. This was on the day that we flew. And this, we give good ground truth to his, validate his measurement system. So Steve was lost. The main point of the whole project, in my viewpoint, was to get Steve to put up some money for a better sailplane that could go to a lot higher. And he had agreed to do this, and we had embarked on designing and building a new sailplane when he was lost. The new sailplane is a little bigger, 85-foot wing, a little lighter, 1,700 pounds rather than 1,800, designed with no engine, a two-seater with a pressure cabin, so we don't need pressure suits anymore. Down here, it's altitude limit 90,000 feet. Originally, we wanted to go to 100,000. But technically, it's a little more, you're into a little bit more uncharted territory. You end up getting some shock waves between 90 and 100,000 feet. And to make a very efficient airplane with shock waves can probably be done, but it hasn't been done very at these conditions. And so we chose to be conservative and go to 90,000. There's a mock-up that we use to size the seats and the windows and the instrument panel and the controls and get all that stuff right before we build the airplane. Here's a picture of the airplane as designed. There's the cloud we want to fly up above, or one like it. And there we are coming down from an altitude higher than any powered plane has ever sustained in level flight, which would be about 91,000 feet. And no power plane can hold altitude at that flight, at that altitude, but we can. So, I think we're ready to go for questions.
Our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and while we don't have time to take questions on air, we will take questions off air at the close of this program. I'm Barbara Massey, a member of the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and we thank Einar Ennevoldsen for his comments today on the Perlan Project.